This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. A couple weeks ago, New America Indianapolis and the Indianapolis Recorder launched an online series about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the Black community. WFYI and Side Effects Public Media are joining the collaboration. And here at All In, we wanted to join in as well. So today, we're talking with a live panel of guests about what unique challenges the Black community faces right now and what can be done to address those challenges. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, we are live. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, 866-476-3881. Joining us on Skype is Ron Rice, an organizer for Riverside Neighborhood and Flanner House. Ron, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Also calling in on Skype is Keith Pashal, all known by most as Wildstyle, an Indianapolis artist, an activist, and an ambassador for the Central Indiana Community Foundation. Thanks, Wildstyle.
Thank you.
On the phone, we have Kelly Jones, CEO and co-founder of Be Nimble Foundation and the Black Hatch Fund. Thank you, Kelly.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also on the phone is Latoya Pitts, CEO of Christomore House. Latoya, thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
All right. Since so much of this topic is about community, I want to start out by understanding what roles each of you have. Ron, can you explain what you do in Riverside Neighborhood and at Flanner House?
Sure. My title is the community builder. It was the Northwest Quality of Life, now it's the near Northwest area. So my job is to basically help to improve the quality of life of all the residents and stakeholders, schools, churches of the area. I do a lot of networking, a lot of event planning, promoting. I do a lot of convening for resident-led committees in the area, and try to collaborate with different organizations to help bring resources in so that the community is aware of what they have available to them and what things they can do to improve their own lives.
All right, thanks, Ron. Wildstyle, you do photography for the hip-hop scene in Indianapolis, among other things. Can you tell us what role you see yourself in right now in your community?
Well, I'm also actually in the Northwest / Riverside neighborhood, so Ron is he lives a couple of streets away from me. And I'm a Central Indiana Community Foundation ambassador. So far, my role has really been on supporting community efforts to help each other. And the Central Indiana Community Foundation has, you know, been able to leverage some connections and funding to do all of that as well.
And Kelly, what is the Be Nimble Foundation and the Black Hatch Fund?
We created Be Nimble Foundation in late 2016 with the need to directly address Black and brown entrepreneurs in the technology ecosystem. So focused on helping people of color, specifically Black people, create businesses that use tech or use technology in order to create scalable initiatives. Out of Be Nimble Foundation, we've ran several fundraisers and events and have contributed that money directly back to Black entrepreneurs and workshops and other things that we're able to launch. 2 years ago, we launched Black Hatch Fund, which is our capital generating company. So we now do venture capital investments, and we also have an accelerator that we've run for the last 2 years. And to date, we've worked with about 25 Black tech entrepreneurs just in Central Indiana alone, and we'll continue to do that into the near future.
All right. And Latoya, you're the CEO of Christomore House. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes. So Christomore House is a community center that services Hallville and the Near West Side. We've been in business since 1905, so more than 110 years. And at our center, we provide services such as early childhood education. We have after-school programs. We have a senior citizen program. We assist with rental bills. We pay. We help people from becoming homeless. We provide meals. You name it. It's a one-stop multi-services center.
And Ron, let's get back to you. How has the pandemic impacted you and the work that you do so far?
So we've basically put everything, our normal activities on hold, a lot of our meetings. We do hold you know, our WebEx meetings and whatnot. But we've shifted more towards trying to starting off with getting a good food distribution for all of our vulnerable families that are in the near Northwest and beyond that. We started off helping out with that, helping the MLK Center, and then we started to organize and get our IPS schools, all the families that are on the food assistance there. So then we were able to get an alliance with the churches. We have quite a few churches in the near Northwest area. So right now, the Near Northwest Faith Partners just became a nonprofit. They have been doing a tremendous job, led by President and Pastor Bowman, Tyrese Bowman of Greater Zion Fellowship Community Center. And we're basically setting up where every single day, anyone in the neighborhood, anyone in the community can get a hot meal and also groceries. And that's like every single day we've got a different church that is available to people in the area. And we've also been working on trying to put out more information on employment opportunities. We know a lot of people got laid off. And also we're trying to address some of the mental health issues that we know are existing and are going to be coming more more enforced in the next couple of weeks or so.
Has finding personnel for this been a challenge? I imagine volunteers are hard to come by these days. And even then, when you get them, the protocol is so stringent. How have you been dealing with that?
Sure. The, honestly, it's, you know, getting people to volunteer is always a challenge, I think, for everybody. Surprisingly, we have been slammed with people wanting to assist, and not only in our neighborhood, but some of our neighboring, like 16 Tech was one of the first people to jump on and ask what they can do to help out. So we've been getting that. And then we've had very good people keeping in touch with the health department and keeping in touch with any kind of current news on what proper protocol should be. We've actually, even now today, we were sending out food boxes and gift cards to the Flanner families and the Flanner House families. And even on our paperwork that we sent out with the riders and drivers, we were able to not only have a list of everybody and how to contact them, but also to who was the last person that touched those boxes. So just in case something were to ever happen, we have a
We may have lost Ron again. Wildstyle, what about the communities that you're a part of? What has the impact been there?
It's been tense in some moments and a lot of, just uncertainty. There's a lot of people that are, worried about rent assistance and utility assistance right now. And even though there's a moratorium on shutoffs and evictions, you know, all of that, you know, is still continuing to add up. And so there's a lot of uncertainty with that. And that's one of the solutions, that I and some of the CICF ambassadors are looking at it, is how to sustain people, not just the immediate needs, but how to sustain them next month and 6 months down the line, and to make sure that, you know, the community is going to be hopefully thriving when the rest of society gets back from this shutdown.
Yeah. And all along those lines, you mentioned shutoffs and evictions. What kind of a guarantee have you gotten from, the people in charge, the people in power where those things are concerned, that when everything comes back to normal per se, that those things don't just start right back up, shutoffs, evictions, things like that, when it's going to take a while for people to get back on their feet?
Well, honestly, you know, we haven't been able to get a lot of clear and concise answers on that situation. And that is, undoubtedly frightening to a lot of people that may be behind on the rent at this point, or maybe behind on their, their utility bills that come May 5th or whenever the current governor's order ends. That they could be shut off and that the next day they could be getting evicted. So, you know, right now we don't really have a lot of certainty on what's going on. And there needs to be that. And then also some are experiencing harassment from landlords because they're not able to pay, and that the landlords can't actually evict them, but that doesn't, you know, necessarily take away their power to intimidate. And so that is also an issue.
Kelly, we had a show last week about small businesses, and we heard from a few business owners from around the state who were struggling and adapting, if they can, to get through this. What kind of an impact are you seeing on business owners and entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting time. I think how we've chosen to kind of go about it is in a few ways. I think, one, we obviously see the direct impact to businesses in general, all small businesses, but you especially see that when it regards to the Black businesses. And so, you know, I think providing resources has been a thing that we've been trying our best to do. Obviously, there are the federal aid processes with SBA and PPP, et cetera, but we've created a kit that's accessible on our site that outlines tons and tons of grant opportunities specifically for Black businesses. And so we've been just trying our best to get that in their hands, because a lot of the businesses that we work with on a day-to-day basis aren't really interested in getting into debt, even though some of it could be forgivable. And even on the ones that are forgivable, not every Black business, especially the small Black businesses we work with, have employees that are protected under the Paycheck Protection Program or have salaried employees. And so we're really trying to find ways to directly help businesses that need the help now, you know, not in a few weeks or not if they end up getting a specific loan. I think another thing that we've been really trying to do, and something that has been exciting to us, is because we are a tech and tech-focused organization, we spend a lot of time talking to service-based businesses and brick-and-mortar businesses and helping them understand how to digitize their services. And so taking, you know, companies that have normally been in-person interactions to online interactions, or creating new lines and business models, or creating new streams of income that can potentially support them, not even now, but even into the future.
Kelly, we're going to have to leave it there for now. We have to take a break real fast. But after a break, we'll keep talking with our live panel about COVID-19's impact on the Black community. We would love your questions and comments on social media, and leave us a voicemail. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about COVID-19 in the Black community, and we're live with our panel of guests. So send us your questions or comments. We'll try to get them onto the show. We're live for one more segment. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from. Do that at 866-476-3881. Over Skype and on the phone, we're joined again by our four guests, Ron Rice, an organizer for Riverside Neighborhood and Flanner House, Wildstyle Pashal, an Indianapolis artist, an activist, and an ambassador for the Central Indiana Community Foundation, or CICF. Kelly Jones is CEO and co-founder of the Be Nimble Foundation and the Black Hatch Fund, and Latoya Pitts is CEO of Christomore House. And before we left our last segment, Kelly, I had to rudely interrupt you. I'm so sorry about that. You were busy talking about the business communities you serve here in town and how COVID-19 has really, really impacted them.
Yeah, I think where I left off is, you know, we found an opportunity with a lot of the businesses we work with currently, and also businesses that we haven't had the opportunity to touch, to start creating new revenue models and new business strategies. I think this has shown itself to be a time of innovation and making a way out of no way. And I think the Black community has, you know, by DNA, done that for a really long time. And so we're also seeing a lot of businesses that are pivoting. And I think the last thing is, you know, although we have all these resources available, grants, loans, et cetera, it's going to take a lot of time for those things to come through. And so we've been working really hard in finding ways to do gap grants that's going to either, one, help companies pivot and be a little bit more nimble in their business models and creating digital tools to keep going, or two, just to help them cover bills. And so, you know, I'd welcome everyone to stay up to date on BeNimbleCo.com to see when we release those grants. But we're looking to give out anywhere between $2,500 and $5,000 to 100 Black businesses over the next 2 weeks.
That could mean a lot. Latoya, Christomore House is a family and community center. And I mean, people getting together in the same physical space is so important for a place like that. So how have things changed for you?
Oh, things have changed quite dramatically. So we offer services, as I previously stated, that are like basic needs services. So the biggest change you'll see here is, like you said, we are a community-based organization. So we're used to people being in our center and, you know, just being that community affair. And so we've had to move to remote and drive-through. Now, we still offer the same services. If you need meals, we still provide those. If you need access to, like I said, utility assistance or rental assistance, or you need cleaning supplies, it just looks a little different. So instead of coming into our building, you're actually greeted at the door. You stay outside. You fill out the forms. Or we can do them over the phone. You can reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, our Twitter accounts. And we're still providing those same services. It's just you're not getting that face-to-face contact anymore unless you, of course, drive up and we're outside. Where our staff are coming and bringing the items and putting them in your car. So it's shifted a little bit. It's been a you know, a learning curve for my staff. They all do what they do because they love being around people. So not being able to see our students come into the building, not being able to, you know, hug our families. It's been a bit of a struggle, but, you know, we just keep a smile on our face and know that we're still making a huge impact because these families still need these access to these resources.
This question here is for everybody, for anyone who wants to chime in. How is this pandemic and all the complicated consequences of it different for people in the Black community?
So this is Latoya from Crystal Moore House. I would say the biggest difference is just getting access to the resources. So when you hear pandemic and all of the things that the news were saying we needed to do to prepare, you need to buy groceries for 2 weeks. Some people are working from home. In the Black community, we do a lot of hands-on service type jobs. And so a lot of our jobs we're not able to do remotely. So you still have people in the Black community that have to go in. We're the people that are, you know, sometimes working in the hospitals. We are working for your Amazons. We're working at Walmart. And so those are essential jobs, right? And so you still have to go in. You're not necessarily able to remove yourself from society and kind of hunker down at home how the government is, you know, requesting and asking that you do. And so people working in the Black community, Be Nimble, our CICF ambassadors like Wildstyle and Ron Rice, like we're still out on the front lines and we're trying to make sure that our families are equipped to handle this pandemic as it's occurring because we're not able to kind of shift and change how we do business like a lot of our Caucasian counterparts are.
And Ron, I mean, this brings me back to what you said in your introduction about food distribution and the challenges around that. I mean, the importance of that seems really, really big right now to get people the right kind of food, because a number of the people in the communities that you serve live in so-called food deserts. Has that been something that's been top of mind in your organization?
You can hear me now, right?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. So yes, that is, that's always been a struggle, here. We've got, since last June had, Cleo's Bodega opened up. And so we've been using, Cleo's for the time being as a hub, to get, everyone organized, and, Flanner House, Brandon Cosby, actually liquidated everything in the store to go out to families. And so now he's going to be opening back up again the next week, so that we'll have people will have a close source to be able to pick up food and also supplies. We're going to be focused a little bit more on cleaning supplies here starting off. And so it's always been an issue. Transportation is always an issue of getting to those places. So we've been doing a lot more delivering offering our services to be able to pick up groceries for any of our seniors or anyone who can't make it out, using the Lyft program for the seniors that we started back in December, for the seniors to be able to only have to be charged just $1 to actually go out and get a ride out to one of the grocery stores in the Lyft radius. But it's always going to be a challenge, but it's not something that can't be challenged. We've got quite a few people who want to do and have been doing the right thing and looking out for their neighbors. So a lot of it's really communication, just trying to find out who is in need, how can we get to them. I've been really trying to push a lot of people to share, you know, anyone that they know, any of their neighbors that are in a situation like this where they can't get out or they don't have anyone in their family. So we've been having that. That's been like our biggest challenge, really, is trying to find out who it is that we need to get to. Because I have a very large area, probably around 30,000 residents, and that takes. I obviously don't know who everybody is, but somebody knows who somebody is.
WildStyle, how do you maintain a sense of community and reap all the benefits that you get from a community when so many people are staying inside their homes?
Well, I think, you know, phone calls is definitely a plus, but I think in you know, like LaToya was saying, a lot of people in the Black community still have to go out. So, I mean, you kind of have two cases where either they're an essential worker or they're laid off. So there's still people out and about. And you do see people, you know, if you're out walking, you know, I think a lot of people are practicing safe distancing, and then some people aren't. But there's still a sense of community. I can tell you a specific example is the seniors home at 30th and Clifton, where I, right before the shutdown happened, I went over there to check on people and, you know, you see what was going on. And, you know, one of the residents had told me that the residents that have more than enough will bring their food down to the common areas, and which allowed the other people that didn't have enough food or whatever was needed to go ahead and take what they need. So, you know, community is still providing for each other. The neighborhood associations, Riverside Civic League and the Northwest Planners Neighborhood Associations are heavily involved in taking care of its own residents. So the sense of community is strengthened in some ways.
Kelly, are business owners as aware of their options as they should be? Like, what's helping to raise that awareness, and what more could be done?
Yeah, I think when it comes to a lot of the federal, state, and even city aid, I think a lot of those organizations have done a really great job in trying to advertise, you know, have webinars. You're seeing a lot more Zoom calls and webinars and things like that happening, trying to create awareness around what opportunities are available. But again, there's other resources too that I'm so happy to see people stepping up to really address these issues too, especially as it relates to the black community. I think Verizon and Lyft did a grant program. Shea Moisture just announced two new grant programs, one of which has a deadline of today that you're starting to see come out. And I think you're also starting to see a lot of privately owned organizations like myself that are really trying to step up to the plate to also fill and close those gaps that may be had by people that may not, you know, be able to access SBA loans or may not want to take out debt in order to keep their businesses sustained. And I think another thing that you're starting to see, too, especially as it relates to the tech community and people that, you know, have brick and mortar service-based businesses that are looking to utilize technology a little bit more, you're seeing a lot of webinars about, you know, how to take your business online. A lot of really great people with lots of great resources putting information out. I mean, we do a twice weekly chat with people in different industries talking about what things they can do to kind of get over this hump, you know, to supercharge their business. And so I think you're going to see a combination of, you know, there being, you know, real resources out here on a monetary level, but I think you're also going to see just a level of innovation come out of this that we've never seen before. And it's something that we definitely need to get ready for.
We're on the phone with Kelly Jones, CEO and co-founder of the Be Nimble Foundation and the Black Hatch Fund. We've got a big panel today. We're talking about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on Indiana's Black community. We're also on Skype with Ron Rice, an organizer for Riverside Neighborhood and Flanner House, and a WildStyle, Keith Pashal, is a neighborhood artist and activist and an ambassador for the Central Indiana Community Foundation. We're also on the phone with LaToya Pitts, CEO of Christomore House. LaToya, Christomore House has programming for seniors, and it's important for a lot of seniors to have places like that to avoid isolation. And it's hard for some older people to figure out or even have access to the technology that's needed right now to make up for that isolation with something like video calls. What are you doing and what can be done to help them right now?
What are we doing? So we're making sure that our senior coordinators are talking to the seniors. They do, a lot of them have cell phones, and so that was one of the programs that we were doing before we had to go on isolation or shutdown. So our seniors do actually have access to tablets that they were learning to use. IUPUI is who we had partnered with for that program. So their coordinators are making sure that they're calling and checking on them. They're talking to them. They're delivering things and making sure they're dropping them off at the door. At least they're seeing some type of friendly face-to-face contact. So even though it's not, we can't reach out and touch you, you can still open your door. You can see us. We're driving by. We're talking to them. So I would just encourage you that if you do have seniors in your family, that you're making sure that you're communicating with them, because a phone call and a smile at their door goes a really long way because they already feel isolated. And so this is just making it even more of a difficult time for them and a challenge. But checking to make sure if they need anything. We do a lot of deliveries to our seniors. We're making sure that they're still getting their healthy meals for breakfast and lunch. We're dropping off family meal boxes and things that are simple and easy for them to be able to cook and microwave. We're, like I said, we're making sure that we're talking to them, we're reaching out to them. And so those are the things that Crystal Morehouse has been doing to make sure that our seniors are still connected and feel connected to the community.
And Wild Style, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and so getting accurate information is really important at a time like this. Have you seen any issues around misinformation that could be prevented or addressed in some way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, the conspiracy theories and that the conspiracy theorists are going wild right now. And I think that is definitely an issue. And I think also that a lot of people simply have a lack of information. They don't know, you know, if you don't have internet in some places, you know, you have to wait for the network and the newscast to tell you what's going on. And so a lot of people simply don't know where to get help. That's been an issue that I've noticed. Even though there may be help down the street, they just may not be aware of what the programs are because things came up so quickly. And so, you know, information and getting that out there to, you know, to everyone in the Black community, regardless of socioeconomic status, you know, has been difficult.
Kelly, what are you hearing from people who you talk to who are in tough situations? What are they worried about?
Well, I think historically, you know, Black-owned businesses have always been kind of the lesser when it comes to getting resources and things like that, too. So I think something like this happening doesn't do anything but handicap them even more, right? I think the biggest things that I'm hearing are, one, you know, there's like I mentioned before, there's loan opportunities. A lot of people don't want loans. A lot of people may not, you know, be able to apply for some, you know, versus others, despite, you know, what's been said to us. So really understanding the navigation of that. And then the other part being, you know, what are other opportunities out there? I mean, I think the things that business owners are looking for now more than anything is the ability to continue to make money. So, you know, it's either apply for these loans and hope that we can get them to sustain us and take out debt, you know, look at grant opportunities and hope that we can pick something up to stay out of debt or prevent ourselves from becoming insolvent, or figure out a way, you know, given the circumstances that we're in, to find a way to pivot or find a way to maximize the opportunity to create something new. And I'm starting to see just kind of a little bit of everything. You know, that's everything from, you know, a beautician that, you know, 2 weeks ago probably had a full book for April and now has no book and has to look at other opportunities to create revenue for herself, right? So she's leaning into things like YouTube and creating kits for her clients that they can buy so they can do their hair at home. I think we're going to just start seeing more of that, and we're going to see that that's going to become an opportunity for business to continue to thrive. So while we're waiting on, you know, our grants and loans and things like that, you know, I think people are really trying to figure out how they can just make it happen, whether that's keeping cash flow, you know, having to lay people off, you know, all of these things that we're kind of faced with. And so I think we just have to wait it out and see and hope that, you know, in post-COVID-19, 2020, that we'll be able to get ourselves back to square one in the, you know, 2 to 3 months is probably going to take for us to bounce back.
Just got about a minute left. Time flies. I'm curious from each of you, what have you seen from your communities that makes you hopeful and that you hope to see more of? before this is all over?
I can actually say that the way that people have been responding, not only individuals, but also a lot of the businesses and nonprofits, such as 913 Sports has been picking up all of the Gleaner loads for everybody. Now I think they're pretty much covering almost the entire city in a way. Indigo buses for delivering food with our riders to the residents. And then people like Wildstyle, who has literally been out here walking these streets, trying to find out who needs what. I mean, literally, we talk to each other almost every other day, just an update to make sure we're doing the right thing for the community for the long haul and not just a quick fix. So that's been the most encouraging thing, is just seeing everyone working together. We saw a lot of cracks in the system when we first started, just to be perfectly honest, and we started to see where we need to start filling these voids so that when something like this happens again, we're not kind of caught with our pants down. So I just want to say thank you to Wildstyle, who's on here now.
And thank you, Ron. We're short on time. Ron Rice is organizer for Riverside Neighborhood and Flanner House. Wildstyle is on with us as well. Thank you so much. Kelly Jones, thank you. And Latoya Pitts, we appreciate your time. Up next, we've got Bronson Tucker Edmonds from the Indiana University School of Medicine. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on COVID-19 and the Black community. We've talked in today's show with a group of artists, advocates, and neighborhood organizers. Now, a conversation with Bronson Tucker Edmonds, the Assistant Dean for Diversity Affairs at Indiana University School of Medicine. Good afternoon, Bronson.
Good afternoon.
So before we get started, can you tell us what you do at the IU School of Medicine?
Sure. So I'm an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology. So my clinical work is in women's health care. I am also a health services researcher, which means that I do research to sort of inform and understand sort of policy and practice on how we deliver health care. And my administrative job, working in the dean's office as one of our assistant deans for diversity affairs, thinking about the needs in terms of representation and inclusivity and cultural competence for our learners and for our faculty members.
So how has that work, though, changed since the pandemic started? What are you focused on right now?
I think it's fair to say that the entire healthcare enterprise is pretty focused on COVID-19, on keeping patients safe, keeping providers safe, making sure that learners and trainees can continue to get their education as seamlessly as possible, though at every level, life has been disrupted at this point in time. But yeah, everything right now is really in how do we adapt to sort of this new world that we're living in.
Part of your work is on health disparities. What disparities have you seen so far with the spread of the virus itself and testing and treatment for it?
Sure. So I've been really concerned with these reports that have been coming out. And I think it's actually for the better that we are seeing more national attention and media coverage with regard to some of the numbers that are coming out of major cities showing really alarming disparities, particularly with regards to rates of infection and, or I should say, with just case numbers and deaths among African Americans. I won't say that it was unexpected, but the degree of the disparities, to see the really the disproportionate number of deaths that are falling onto the Black community has certainly been disheartening and really raised, I think, a host of concerns about why at the national level we're not taking more intentional steps toward ensuring that the data that we're collecting is including race and ethnicity, and that the sort of policies and strategies that we're taking in thinking about resource utilization and distribution are not paying attention to these issues of equity.
Well, and a new report from the Washington Post shows that the coronavirus appears to be killing and infecting Black Americans at a disproportionately high rate. According to the publication's analysis of the early data from across the country, do you know how solid the evidence is for that and why it might be happening?
I mean, I'll take that in two parts. In terms of how solid the evidence is, I mean, I don't think that it's inaccurate. And like I said, it's, and I'll speak to a second why I don't think that it's entirely surprising, but I do think that we have huge gaps right now in our testing capabilities. You know, I think this pandemic has sort of shined a light on some of the real inadequacies and gaps that we had in as a nation in terms of our readiness to sort of attend to public health crises and sort of emergency kind of preparedness concerns. I would say that those numbers, I think that the public should believe them in terms of how exactly sort of precise or accurate they are. There's probably a lot that we still don't know because we don't have really widespread availability of testing because people are still having to, you know, kind of really ration in a lot of settings the tests that they're utilizing because our turnaround times are still not where we hope for them to be in terms of rapid testing availability. And because of just longstanding health inequities and health disparities, you know, we also know that communities of color have less access, frankly, to getting these tests, so tests being available in the settings where they receive care. So, I mean, I think that we can believe that there are significant disparities. I think the question of exactly how firm those numbers are is sort of in the realm of there's a lot that we still don't know. And I think that what's driving, you know, this disproportionate burden of disease for, you know, African Americans is, you know, systemic inequity and kind of systemic racism, which we've, you know, been paying attention to in the health disparities realm for some time now, just really naming it as such, because there are ways that marginalized communities, be it lower income, socioeconomically marginalized, racially marginalized communities, really are at a disadvantage when you sort of try to institute a social distancing set of strategies, because oftentimes those are populations that are working in sort of service sector, in way, you know, kind of lower wage kind of positions, things that are still essential, but oftentimes there may not be adequate protections, you know. So you think about people who are making sure that our hospitals are still sort of up and running and clean and that, you know, food's being served, when you're thinking about migrant workers who are making sure that our grocery stores still have food on the shelves, public transportation, that our trash is being collected, a host of essential functions. Oftentimes, you know, those are jobs that are held disproportionately by people of color in lower income sort of socioeconomic stratas. And so what comes with that, these essential workforce needs, is additional risk for coming in contact with and contracting the infection. So I think that the workforce piece is really something to pay attention to, because there's sort of a notion of, like, you know, stay at home. And I've been one to be in different venues saying stay at home, but we forget that there's that's a luxury, right? And that not everyone is able to, and that a lot of people are also, you know, would love to be able to stay home, but if they are going to keep their jobs, they need to show up. So then that goes back to those employers, and in those spaces are protections being put in place to try to mitigate the spread of disease for people who have to show up and do their jobs. The other piece around what's contributing to these disparities, we already know that, you know, historical inequity has led to disproportionate burden of other chronic diseases among communities of color. And so when you're looking at hypertension and asthma and diabetes, we know that that is creating particular vulnerabilities to the infection and to poorer outcomes related to it. And we're looking at, you know, issues with regards to access to testing. Something that occurred to me earlier that I haven't yet sort of pinned down fully in terms of my thinking, but it strikes me that one of the strategies that we're utilizing as healthcare providers to determine who should be tested has to do with whether people have these comorbid conditions and immune compromised, you know, kind of high risk category. But it also strikes me that because African Americans in particular are, you know, less likely to be insured, you know, it's not uncommon for me to see a new OB patient who has never really had access to care until they were pregnant. And so if you ask them if they have health problems, comorbidities, they're like, no, you know, I'm healthy. And it's not until they've had interactions with the healthcare system that they find out that they have high blood pressure, have diabetes. So I also sort of wonder about the implications of the sort of underinsurance and lack of insurance that's prevalent, more disproportionately impacting communities of color, and what that means in terms of even our screening strategies for how to make the determination whether someone should be tested or not if they fall into certain categories of risk. So these are just things that I think, again, we need to be considering with intention how we're going to utilize our resources based on the populations that are most at risk for infection and for poor outcomes. And I think without the data available to inform those decisions, we really do ourselves and the public a disservice, you know, particularly communities of color. So that's where my concern is lying with regards to these disparities and the lack of data.
And there's also the trust issue, too, which has become a factor in so many things related to healthcare and people of color. And
huge one.
When we talk about the maternal mortality and the infant mortality rate in Indiana, that certainly comes in as a factor. And I'm sure that it's going to be a factor when it comes to COVID-19. How concerning is that for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the fact that there's, well-documented healthcare mistrust and, frankly, mistreatment, you know, of people of color in the healthcare system, people feeling like they're not heard, they're not believed, they're not treated equitably, that their pain is not believed, that their symptoms are dismissed. I mean, these are realities that are well-documented. And I think that, you know, those things only further disadvantage folks from their maybe being reluctant to present for care or feeling like they've shown up for care and been sent away. Do I go back again now that my symptoms are worse? Will I be taken seriously? Will I be dismissed? Will it matter? You know, I think those are things that we have to take seriously, that patients are considering in the face of, you know, symptoms that, you know, they may be at home trying home remedies rather than trying to present for care. And again, the financial realities of not having insurance potentially and thinking, do I go to an emergency room right now, get sent home with no help, and then have there be worries about bills and things. And so there's been some measures that have been taken to try to mitigate some of that. But I think that the reality is that that's the mindset a lot of people carry, real challenges and real concerns about how they will be treated. Can they afford the care? Should they even bother? And that could be disastrous if you couple that at the level of communities of people not presenting for care that's needed.
We've seen some data on the overall response to the stay-at-home order, and it seems mostly positive, but there are definitely some areas in the state and some parts of the country where it hasn't been strictly followed for a number of reasons. Stay-at-home orders, do you think, from what you've seen, been taken seriously enough?
I think it's a good question. I think, you know, there were some unfortunate things happening early on with regards to different, and you may have seen it in the news. They've written a little bit about, you know, there were rumors flying around about whether Black folks were, you know, kind of immune. And I think maybe that was at first in jest. And then there were, I think, maybe some seriousness that people were considering around it. And yeah, I mean, I think that there are a number of different reasons. And then, like I already said, some of this stay at home and I wish I could stay home, but I can't. So I think that there's a combination of things that have maybe the message wasn't taken as seriously as early as it could have been, you know, and I could imagine it taking a little bit more time in certain pockets to really kind of hit home in terms of the seriousness of it. So, yeah, I can't say with any sense of I know for sure that people are or aren't staying at home, but I can definitely imagine that it may have been a slower uptake. And then I think on top of that, you put sort of the burden or the reality of having to go into certain kinds of jobs, and that also makes it more difficult to really adhere to the stay-at-home orders. Yeah.
Do you have an opinion on the state's response so far to COVID-19?
I mean, I have to say, all things considered, we were getting stay-at-home orders and sort of getting that kind of guidance earlier than a lot of other places. So I have appreciated that action was taken while other states, their leadership sort of sat back or sort of dug in around not requiring, you know, not taking statewide measures. So I will say that I have felt that was a positive set of steps that were taken on the part of our leadership. You know, I wish we'd have had, you know, that the testing was more robust earlier, but I don't put that on the state. I think that speaks to a larger failure at the federal level of the leadership that we've had in regard to this entire crisis. So, yeah, I think as far as things fall at the state level, I think that measures were taken early on to try. And you could always look back and criticize things, you know. But, yeah, I actually think that the response has been timely and that they've been doing the best that they could with the resources that they had.
We've been talking to several medical professionals in the last several weeks about everything. And so I want to ask what you're worried about right now or concerned with more than anything else with, say, the timeline of this pandemic or what could be coming in the future should people, I guess, not take the care that they need.
Yeah. I mean, I really am very concerned about our numbers in, you know, I'll say the Black community and communities of color more largely in terms of just appreciating the seriousness. I think with the coverage, that's why where I started earlier on, that people are appreciating it and hopefully taking it more seriously. I hope that it's not too late, though, because I do think that the community spread is, you know, kind of gotten out in front of us. And so I worry about where we're going to really peak with regards to these outcomes. I worry about some of the ways that I don't know that our leaders, and this is both at the state level, federally, otherwise, hospital level, you know, are really taking seriously or considering the ways that we may then need to make adjustments in our policies and resource allocation to try to mitigate some of these disparities. And also the fact that I don't know if there's enough input coming from communities of color, small things that may end up being huge things, like the masking provisions that came out through the CDC. I've been reading just in media that there's been responses from communities of color, that Black men in particular, but that Black folks not necessarily feeling safe to mask because of being, you know, sort of stopped by police and concerns about whether that could endanger them, given that we know we have challenges with police violence and Black people being viewed as a threat, you know, let alone having bandanas over your face. So that was, you know, one of those things that wouldn't maybe occur to folks unless they had people at the table who had that lived experience to sort of raise that set of concerns. Similarly, when you think about some of the issues about the possibility of, like, you know, enforcing quarantines or enforcing stay-at-home orders, and again, thinking about what it means for, you know, Black people already facing disproportionate risk for being stopped, you know, by police, and, you know, what those outcomes look like, and you know, more likely to face sort of violence or you know, even death with those kinds of encounters. So when I start to think about where we could end up if we're not engaging communities of color, you know, both socially and financially disadvantaged communities, if we're not really having folks at the table as policies are being made, then I worry that we're not fully taking into consideration the potential unintended consequences. And the last thing I'll speak to is that if and when you know, we were to get to that point about having to allocate scarce resources, you know, allocate ventilators and even providers and things like that. Again, I think our nation's history is one in which, you know, communities of color tend to kind of draw the short stick and the short straw, I should say, and that they historically have been sort of disadvantaged when resource allocation becomes scarce. And so, again, without intention and thinking about that upfront when we're creating algorithms and practices, if we're going to do it based on comorbidities, well, again, that's going to disadvantage, you know, people who are disadvantaged because inequity is baked into sort of our health status. So, yeah, I mean, there are ways that I worry about us not taking seriously these issues of equity upfront as we're making policy considerations, because I don't want us to start thinking about it once we get everything in place and then not realize that we've made some major misses that come at the expense of people's lives. So those are the kinds of things that I think about with regards to the issues around equity and how this pandemic will continue to unfold.
Bronson Tucker Edmonds is the Assistant Dean for Diversity Affairs at Indiana University School of Medicine. Thanks so much for your insight and thanks for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our technical director is Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, our conversation is on loss and grief during a pandemic. If you have questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.